chili. Waffle, waffle chili. Waffle, waffle chili. Waffle, waffle chili.
Aloha, this is Dennis Kamakahi, and you are tuned into KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea.
Horses Are Good, a concept store selling paniolo and English tack, traditional Hawaiian clothing and accessories, specialty sodas, garden supplies, books, records, cassettes, and more. Open 11 to 6 every day except Tuesday and Wednesday on Papalina Road in Kalaheo. 808-378-2116. Website is horsesaregood.com.
Got bees? Doug the Bee Guy is proud to support KKCR, providing beehive extractions island-wide for over 20 years. Also, offering honey, propolis tincture, and wax. Doug the Bee Guy, the hum of bees is the voice of the garden. 808-212-4178.
Wainiha Country Market proudly supports.
We're not here to endorse, enforce, change your course. We're not doctors, lawyers, or professional counselors or therapists. Please call those folks directly. This show is meant to get us all comfortable with thinking about our deaths, with thinking about a plan for our loved ones after we've departed, and an idea of what we believe. In doing so, we're forced to look upon our lives. When we do this, we leave with a little more thankfulness, a little more love for ourselves, our lives, our loved ones, and what we've accomplished so far in this short period on Earth.
Aloha, and welcome to the Kauai Death Cafe. We're live today in studio. How are you, Susan?
I'm pretty good. How are you, Jenna?
I'm good. We're both here. Doing the work.
By a miracle.
It's a little bit of a dreary day over here, but the sky's been a beautiful blue.
And amazing grays, like always.
Ooh, it has been nice. So today I thought that we would talk about what happens when you die, and more in specifically, maybe different ways that people die. There's a list of ways that people die, and it's cataloged. It's the top 10. there's a top 10 one for the world, and then there's a top 10 one for our nation. And actually, this one's printed by the CDC, and these are preliminary numbers. The only official numbers that are out right now are for 2023 and 2022. The WHO only has up to 2021 as official numbers. So this one is the top 15 leading causes of death in the United States. And these are preliminary numbers. So, and, you know, it's interesting, but diseases of the heart and malignant neoplasms, which would be cancer, those are the top two, with diseases of the heart being number one. And they're only about 40,000 apart.
Oh, and this is undocumented, but I heard in a few places that one of the top three is a medical errors. So don't quote me, but that's up there. That's not counted, as I've been told.
Well, I guess if you're the doctor and you're doing the charting,
you're not gonna add that.
I'm not writing that. That's not on here, but number three is accidents.
Oh, so a doctor could be an accident.
So in there we have unintentional injuries. But motor vehicle injuries are in there, and some other injuries are in there. It seems like somewhere along the lines, I used to think that was one of the more rarer cases, is to die of an accident, really like 10% of people. But I mean, it seems to be quite up there.
Well, if we include the medical profession, because they don't call it intentional.
Yeah.
Then that could be why it's up there.
Yeah. So that's the third leading cause. And then cerebral vascular disease is the fourth, chronic lower respiratory disease, is the fifth.
Is that what I have with pneumonia?
You don't have a disease. You don't have a disease.
What do you?
You
call?
Just have dis-ease. I think it's how you say it.
Yeah, we can say that.
Let's see. Alzheimer's is number five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No, 6. Alzheimer's is number 6.
So where does dementia? They don't even consider them two separate things. Because Alzheimer's is just a form of dementia, from mm-hmm. what I understand.
Yeah, I think it's everything in that category. Yeah.
Well, that's unfair, because dementia is kind of sweet. Alzheimer's can get a little gnarly.
I think that dementia is a symptom of Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's is a symptom of dementia, maybe. Because Alzheimer's is a specific behavior that seems to be tied into the general dementia, but...
Well, you've got the different types of Alzheimer's,
of
like...
dementia.
Well, no, I think the disease is Alzheimer's named...
Well, this is funny, because I thought the disease is Alzheimer's, and one of the ways... it says that in that book, How We Die, that one of the...
I have that book.
One of the forms of dementia is Alzheimer's, and that's because Dr. Alzheimer found the piece in the brain that made dementia act out like Alzheimer's, which is a different kind of behavior.
Yeah, because you can have dementia with some other types of ailments.
Well, you can have dementia and just become a baby.
And then there's just general senility.
Well, maybe that's it. It's senility, and then there's dementia.
Which is also senile.
Yeah, it's senility, maybe, is the big caption.
I think we should start studying Latin, then we would know.
We'll get more information.
We missed that class.
Yeah, right.
So from Alzheimer's is number 6, the 7th is diabetes.
Well, that's totally environmental, or, I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Environmental or cultural or whatever you want
our
to call
diet
it.
Yeah. Our lifestyle,
yeah,
probably some. I mean, so is the number one
heart.
Yeah,
but ultimately I think all of us get heart disease and die, because I mean when your heart stops pumping.
I was reading in the So there's this book that we kind of based today's show on by Sherwin Nuland called How We Die, Reflections on Life's Final Chapter. And in the book, he calls cardiovascular disease a rich man's disease.
Oh, well.
Because, you know, you're eating rich foods and you're drinking a lot of alcohol. And he was putting it very nicely.
Yeah, he does. He puts it very nicely. And he gives you the positive.
Yeah. But I mean, drinking and eating is some people's sport. You know, that's
addiction.
What
sport,
they do,
yeah.
You know. I mean, it's easy to do. I'm like, let's go on a date. Date night.
Let's eat.
Let's go eat and drink.
Yeah.
You know, rather than like, let's go on a hike or.
Right.
Meet you at the gym. Not happening.
Take a walk.
Yeah.
I just read that, was it in Italy or Spain, one of those countries, they have a word for the equivalent of taking a walk after you eat.
Oh.
And they were saying how beneficial that could be to your health, of course, as obviously it would be. But
they just TiVo?
Huh?
I thought that the word for the healthy thing to do after you drink was a digestivo or an aperitif, which was like a little shot of Sambuca.
Oh.
Or a little shot of limoncello.
Oh, that's supposed to make it all better, right?
I guess it makes that walk a little easier.
Yeah.
So after diabetes, you got nephritis or nephrotic syndrome or nephrosis?
Nephritis.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Nerves? Know. We'll have to Google that one. I think that one has to do with the blood.
Oh.
But the one after that is chronic liver disease and cirrhosis.
We know about that. Might be a culture. That
yeah,
might be
well,
a,
I mean, you can die of chronic liver disease now, just because of your diet.
Oh, Not just alcohol?
Yeah, not just alcohol. There's non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome.
Oh.
Sexy. I'm sure there's non-alcoholic skinny liver syndrome, too. It's from people that were hungry.
Oh, wow, yeah. So is that it?
Let's see. No, there's 15 of them. So nephritis is inflammation of one or both kidneys, often caused by autoimmune, like lupus, or sometimes you can just have a bad reaction to medication and get nephritis. So, let's see. The next one after chronic liver disease and cirrhosis is intentional self-harm, suicide.
What number is that?
I think it's 10. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's 10. And then influenza and pneumonia is 11. Essential hypertension and hypertensive renal disease is 12. Parkinson's 13. Septicemia 14. And COVID-19 15.
COVID made the list.
So, in some of the years past, COVID was the second one.
During the COVID, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's just, it was like a fluke. I mean, it was like a the flu or a virus.
It was or is. Yeah.
So, but it made the list.
That was wild. So, in 2021... which is when it was last official by the WHO. The United States had heart disease was the number one, but COVID was the second one. Alzheimer's and other dementias were third.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, was the fourth one. Drug and drug use disorders was the fifth one.
That was real different in 21 than it is now. Well, where did you get the list for now?
Now is the unofficial list,
oh,
and
okay.
It came from the CDC. This is the WHO.
Okay.
And so lung cancers and bronchial cancers were after stroke, and then kidney diseases, hypertensive disease, and then suicide was the 10th one. So in 2021, it was at 10. Now it's dropped down to 15.
So you can make a survey and see how many of those are you, like I have a whole bunch of those that are in the mix.
Yeah.
But who knows when, so I could see how many out of the 10 I'm likely to go with.
Well, it's funny because only one of them was communicable, which was COVID.
Right.
You know?
The rest of it is self-inflicted. Talk about suicide. Mm-hmm. It can start with those candy bars.
Yeah. Delicious. No, so in talking about this, what I think we sort of were discussing is that there's three different sort of situations that happen when you discuss how you die. You've got the physiological side, which is biological, you know, and then you have psychological, and then the literal, you know. So what happens when you die psychologically, physiologically, and literally?
And the literal one is what you were gonna fill us in on, because you're there on a regular basis.
I can fill you in on that one.
Yeah,
somewhat. Anyway, so I thought we'd talk about that. We're gonna, and we're back. So I'm going to play a clip from Nurse Julie. Nurse Julie is a bit of a curt nurse. She is a hospice nurse, and she's one of those Instagram famous hospice people. But she's going to discuss the biological facts about dying. And she just sort of sums it up really easily for everyone to understand. So here we go.
Facts that I tell people about death.
Yeah, hit me with some biological facts about death.
Your body knows how to die.
Okay.
If you are dying naturally from a disease, but still like you're allowing your body to naturally do it, your body starts kicking in and knows, hey, I'm getting close to death. And it's going to make you a little more introverted. It's going to make you sleep a lot more, eat and drink a lot less, always. And because your body's doing that, it's almost like it's cocooning because it knows that there's a transition coming. And if you allow yourself to do that, you usually will have a really peaceful death if you like, if you listen to your body. Now, certain diseases can cause many symptoms, right?
Sure.
But you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. They usually can be controlled, usually. And your body will naturally start shutting down. And the main thing is that you sleep all the time, not eat and drink. Sleep all the time, not eat and drink. Your body eventually goes into ketosis. Eventually that releases endorphins. You end up feeling good. I mean, 9.8 times out of 10 when I've watched people die, it's very peaceful. It's very peaceful. Now, people don't know what actively dying looks like. And it's their loved one that's dying. So they may not, it may not always translate. Hence why I've made very people say they're graphic video. I've shown real life actively dying because I think people need to know that your loved one's not going to look the same. Their eyes might be open. Their mouth might be open. They might be making funny noises. They're going to breathe differently. Biologically, that's happening metabolically in their body. If you don't know what it looks like, you can look, it looks like your loved one's suffocating. It looks like they have all these secretions. So there's things people need to know so they understand death, so they can really be there with their loved one.
All right.
That was interesting.
Yeah.
And that was on Instagram, which is very informative sometimes.
Well, let's just correct that. That was on my feed in Instagram.
Yeah, that was on my feed. Jenna and I spent a day talking about the show and what we're going to do next, and about maybe talking about the things that happen as we die, like this woman said. And I got home that night and was looking at Instagram, and every other feed was about dying and mortuaries and death, and it's like, I never got those before.
Yeah.
So obviously something was listening to us.
We set our phones too close together.
Yeah, that's what you said.
Yeah.
We shared.
Yeah, so I think that the what she's talking about is the process of dying, the process that we're unaware of, because what we see is 80% of this happens behind closed doors. You know, nurses and orderlies and doctors and MAs and all these physicians assistants and all these other kinds of people are sheltering this from people.
And it's happening internally.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know, the person dying doesn't know they're making a funny face,
no.
Which doesn't mean it's bad. But
yeah. I mean, I think that too, you know, you see a lot of families when you're doing home hospice work that are saying, well, my loved one's not eating and drinking, and that's a problem, we need to feed them, you know? And it actually can hurt to eat food or hurt to drink or exacerbate the situation. Like, why isn't he getting an IV? He's dehydrated. And it's like sometimes pumping all of this stuff through you is going to end up blowing your organs out faster than it would if you just didn't. You know, it will cause pain to have a bunch of extra fluid.
What if they're not hungry?
Yeah, and you're not hungry. I mean, and that brings me to this, to the thing I like to talk about all the time in the Bardo practice, where you lose your fire is one of the things that you lose first. The ability to burn a calorie isn't necessary anymore, you know, so you don't have to put any food in to create that fire inside. And that's usually one of the first carnal elements that we lose when we die. And so then you go on to, you know, maybe it's not the fire that you lose first, it's the earth, because you're now bed bound. You know, you become in some way that you're no longer sitting up and doing the stuff where your feet touch the earth, and now they are in a bed, you know. So a lot of people end up losing earth first, then fire, then water, because you fail to drink, don't need to anymore, and then ultimately air.
Consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And then black increase, right? That's the area in between those two. And I heard this interesting story the other day where a woman was attending someone's death, and at the end, kind of like after the person had seemingly died, they threw up this just amazing amount of black bile, you know? Mm. And in that person's experience, because she knew the person that had passed away, she felt like it was some kind of like, you know, negative spirit that was in her that was finally purged out, because her cause of death was self-inflicted drinking injury, you know, and
like alcoholic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
And had that quote unquote spirit, you know, being purged from her. And I was like, ooh, it's black increase. But I think black increase is also, like you said, the knowledge of being dead and that whole thing. So you can fit through the keyhole. So in the Bardo practice, you're trying to fit through the keyhole or fit through the tiny little hole that all the sand goes through in the hourglass and then come out at the other end in an order that's seemingly the same. So in a burial practice or in a practice of after death, you would be returned to the fire through cremation. You'd be returned to the air through that process of being returned, you know, in fire and becoming smoke and the whole situation. You'd be returned to the water and you'd be returned to the earth. And then you're reincarnated.
And that's all there is.
That's all there is.
Those elements.
Stardust.
The elements coming in and going out. You come in to birth with all of those
elements. Elemental, my dear Watson.
Yes.
So this is another nurse discussing eating and drinking in the biological sense of dying. So let's take a listen.
When a person on hospice stops eating and drinking, how long do they have left to live? In my experience, in most cases, people usually live for another 1 to 2 weeks after they've stopped eating and drinking. However, there are other cases where people live longer, and there are some cases where people die within 24 hours. Every single person is different, but this is a natural part of the dying process. When someone is dying, their systems are shutting down. Food is no longer the priority or the need for a body that is shutting down. It requires too much energy that person no longer has. The person isn't dying because they're not eating or because they're not drinking. They aren't eating and drinking because they are dying.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
But 2 weeks, they say it. They say that stopping to eating and drinking helps you die really fast, but 2 weeks doesn't sound that fast to me. It takes that long to, once you stop eating and drinking.
I've been surprised how long people can go without eating and drinking.
Yeah, and they say, what, you can't go without drinking for
3 days.
Is that what it, that long? Oh, and really you can obviously go longer.
I guess if you're wandering through the desert and you're really, like, you know, taxing your energy, right, you'd die in 3 days. But if you're just chilling in a coma, yeah, dreaming about water, you don't need no water.
You don't need no water.
I mean, it also depends on your situation, too, right? You know?
Yeah.
Like, I think... how long do you think I could go with no food and water?
25 minutes.
I'm like, I'm pretty thin. I don't think it would take long. You know, my friend that just passed away, he was very robust. You know, not a fat guy, but like a muscly person. And he lasted 7 days, and I thought that was a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But, you know, just because of, I think because he's robust. That's why I'm like, everybody with a disease, just don't worry about being skinny. Like, be robust so you can sustain through the situation while you finish the work you've got going on here on Earth. Oy.
Mm-hmm.
That brings us to the psychological part.
That's the interesting
death and
dying part.
Oh, the last thing I wanted to say was about biological death, right, is that to me it seems like it's largely the same, you know, our organs fail to work.
Mm-hmm.
unless you're in one of these accident situations, you know it's your heart that's sort of going to foul out. You can live with an electrical problem in your heart, you know, but it's like once the liver gets involved or once the kidneys get involved, once some other organ becomes involved and there's only, you know, there's now two not working in the trine, that's when it becomes, that's when you basically get septic and die. And so I wonder, in the definition of these numbers, if a heart patient, when their heart fails to beat and they have ischemia or they have heart failure, you know, ultimately what happens is the heart stops beating, the liver stops working, the kidneys stop working, and you become septic and you die, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the process in most things, you know, and most causes of death. And so my takeaway was, like, the process of dying is biologically very similar for most people, you know?
Well, if not identical, because we all lose each one of our organs, mm-hmm. and then we die when we're done.
And I think sometimes the process is slower and sometimes the process is faster, and it just has to do with who we are. Or if you're woo-woo, it has to do with your soul detaching from your body, mm-hmm. and how long that takes and what that looks like. So anyway, very interesting. It's all very interesting. So let's take a little break and we'll come back and we'll talk about the psychological effects of death and dying on a person. All right.
Dying people are often in a kind of in-between zone. And this is probably more likely with people who are dying over a period of time through aging maybe or illness, less with sudden death, but could happen there too. They're in a kind of liminal zone because death is a process. We talk about dying as laboring. It's that we have to labor for body and soul to separate. That takes time and it doesn't happen immediately. And in that process, sometimes the dying are partly in this world and partly in the next world. Perhaps they're sleeping really, really deeply, and in those times of sleeping, they're taking little journeys across, a kind of a traveling sleep. Perhaps they are aware of things that the living aren't aware of. Sometimes they see people, they see things, they hear things. They are tuned into the next reality, but they haven't completely left this one. So it's not unusual for dying people to say, oh, you know, my grandmother was here last night. Or I saw my brother. I'm looking forward to seeing him again in a couple of weeks, but it was wonderful to see him now. The dead come across to visit. And what's important if you're a living person who's supporting a dying person that's happening is to meet their experiences on their own terms. If they say their grandmother was there, say, that's lovely, what did she say? Don't try and reorient them to this reality because they are leaving this reality. What they're doing is going through a very important reorienting process to orient to the new reality where they're going, where we're not going to follow. Not for a while, at least.
Arms there.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Kauai Death Cafe. That was Ruthie Foster. Death came a knocking. She's a musician from Austin.
She might have done my favorite song.
She used to do this amazing brunch in the morning, and you could go and listen to her sing that gospel music like that, and it was so cool. She's so cool. She is larger than life. Mm-hmm. That's Susan's favorite song. One of them.
One of them.
So we were talking about the psychological side of dying. And, you know, there's really no place to begin with that. I guess you could begin with that. The psychological part of dying, you begin with diagnosis. Because I think we fail to understand or really realize and embody the fact that we too can die. You're always like, look at that person, they died. It wasn't me. Good. That's George Carlin's always like, thank God it wasn't me.
Yeah, it's true.
Maybe a death of a parent is a good opener, or a death of a sibling is an opener for that. You might see that light. at some time before. But I think that, you know, diagnosis is the first step for a lot of people to sort of understand how they could die or how they might die.
Or how they, yeah, or that they will die.
Yeah, or that you will die.
Yeah.
And it will be from this something. Thing if you don't have an accident or an injury, top three. For
right.
If one of the other top three doesn't get you. Yeah, so it, you know, it's a psychological blow for a lot of people, and so I think it's at that point in time when you start sort of trying to collect what means something to you, you know, mm-hmm. what psychologically, what do you believe in, you know. I was reading some near-death experience things where somebody had a big heart attack and then had a sort of like a near-death experience and how it psychologically changed their life moving forward after that, you know. It had really changed if you didn't come back from from the experience. But we wouldn't have gotten to hear that one, would we?
Right.
No. So some people are given some pretty profound, you know, gifts and talents because they just sort of figure it out right there at the end when they die. So I think it's all very interesting.
And unknowable.
So there was a podcast that Susan and I were listening to called, was it Buddha at the Gas Pump?
Yeah.
Buddha at the Gas Pump.
And that my friend Jusara sent me, one of my oldest, dearest friends. When we were talking about all this, she turned us on to something new. So thanks, Jusara.
Well, they had a little clip about experience in here, and I thought we might play it. So here it comes.
Physical pain is a fascinating topic. When we're dying,
many people,
and physical pain, it may sound strange, but the most...
Okay, sorry, I hit both buttons at the same time. I'm going to start that one over again. Okay. Buddha at the gas pump. This is talking about experience.
When we're dying, and it may sound strange, but the most beautiful Americans that I've ever met, with very few exceptions, are people who are almost dead because they are willing to be more fully who they are. Everything else is being stripped away. All of our attachments, all of our identities, male, female, rich, poor, big, small, all those things become increasingly irrelevant.
Back in 1970, I was training. I spent 3.5 months training to become a meditation teacher in residence. And a couple of concepts, I picked up several concepts that I've been kind of carrying around with me ever since. And maybe I could tell you those and you could
please
dispel them or comment on them or whatever. One was that if you're the average person and you're deeply attached to the objects of the senses, then when you die, that attachment is sort of torn away from you, and it's said in some Indian philosophies that it's like the sting of 1,000 scorpions being wrenched from the things to which you're attached. Whereas if you're, you know, an experienced meditator of some sort who has devoted a lifetime to experiencing the diving into the transcendent, which in itself is a form of death in a way, because the individual ego is you know, gone beyond, then dying is just like one great meditation in the sense that you're really going for it big time, and you're not you're so accustomed to, you know, relinquishing the indulgence in sensory experience that it's no big deal. So there's another point I'll bring up, but what do you think about that one?
Is it no big deal?
I think it's a big deal. Well,
like they say, if you meditate, if you can disassociate enough with meditation.
I'm going to go back to what Nurse Julie said. Thank God for endorphins.
Who said?
Nurse Julie.
Oh, right.
You know, because it's like birth. You know?
Right. It is.
I've done it both ways. I actually had natural childbirth, and I wasn't in pain. And I know that you know, that the body can do it. It was the endorphins that got me through.
Right.
You know, so I gotta believe that it's very much the same in death. I mean, your liver is changing. It's making enzymes. It's sending endorphins. It's doing its job, even though it can't do its job anymore.
Well, it's doing its final job.
It's doing its new job. Its final job, yeah. Purging.
Good old endorphins.
Ooh-y. So I guess that brings us to talking about pain. Both physical.
Right.
And psychological.
That's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
That's been on my mind. And this guy, I think we're going to play him. He talks about it in a pretty interesting way.
I wonder if it's like, you know, when you get hit in the face, you hit yourself in the nose and your eyes well up and it hurts, but it's got a certain sensation to it that's kind of like, whoa, hey. You ever done that? Hit yourself in the nose really hard?
Or while you're actually in the experience of pain, whatever's doing it, you're really totally in it. So there isn't any observer going, oh, I'm in pain.
Right.
The only time you're in pain is when it's over and you go, that was pain, I was in pain.
Yeah, the only time you have no other thoughts are when you're in pain.
Is pain the only one?
Sneezing.
Or what about sex?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about orgasm or not. I'll try it later and I'll let you know.
Okay.
But I'm doing an experiment for science. Well, let's hear what Buddha at the Gas Pump has to say about pain. Here he goes.
Physical pain is a fascinating topic. I think many people learn a lot about who they are and do a lot of their spiritual practice through their relationship with their physical body.
Mm-hmm.
And you brought up really two things. One, the really sudden intense traumatic pain, and there seems to be a lot of evidence that there is some self-protective mechanism that when somebody's in a horrible accident that consciousness separates from the body and is outside of it. People who have near-death experiences again and again recount that even though their body was burned, smashed, cut, whatever it was, that they were not experiencing the pain, even though the medical personnel were treating it like it was a big emergency. But the other kind of pain, the pain of going to the dentist, or the pain of having arthritis, or the pain of some kind of more chronic pain, can be used as a way of learning how to let go of an automatic rejection of the unpleasant. So, is it possible to go to the dentist and have the dentist drill on your tooth and you're feeling something that is unpleasant, but you don't need to turn that into something that causes you fear? So I watch what happens when small children fall down and skin their knee, for example. A boy is running across the playground, his mother's there, he falls down. And the more fuss he makes, the more attention and comfort that he gets. So he's being conditioned that I should treat pain as an emergency, as a big event, so then I'll get a lot of love. And we kind of take this conditioning into our adult lives. And to me, though, it seems that pain is an emergency signal from segment 23B in the body to the brain saying, hey, there's scraping, cutting, burning going on here. Stop immediately. But once you get that emergency signal, can you just be with the unpleasant sensations and learn to open to them, and then even let that habit in your life extend to being with unpleasant emotions or unpleasant thoughts without immediately closing down, pushing away, getting caught in identification, so that I can go to the dentist and have her drill on my tooth without Novocaine. She pleads with me to take Novocaine for her sake. Mm-hmm. But I would rather have 60 seconds of this intense sensation that I just relax, let it flow through me, rather than get that shot in the gum that makes my mouth feel crazy for the rest of the day. And just even the idea of needles in my gum in the first place isn't particularly pleasant. So the other example is,
what would you do if you had to have an appendectomy?
Well, I probably have to be anesthetized to a certain extent, because the doctor needs me to be completely still when he's doing or she's doing the cutting.
Well, why don't you say, you know, strap me down, don't let, so I can't move.
Okay, well, a number of years ago, I had hip replacement surgery. Mm-hmm. And there was a period of time about an hour after the surgery when the surgical anesthesia wore off and the post-surgical anesthesia hadn't kicked in. And they had cut through the largest muscle in my body, my gluteus maximus. And I experienced the most intense pain I've ever felt in my life for about half an hour. Now, I did have the advantage of knowing that it was going to go away soon when the morphine kicked in. But during that half hour, I was in ecstasy. The pain was so intense that all I could do was be with the pain. There was no distracted thought. There was no worrying about anything else. My whole universe was those sensations.
This Dale guy is cool. We're back. Kauai Death Cafe. So that was Dale Borgum, and he was being interviewed by the guy that does Buddha at the Gas Pump Experience. And here, actually, I have a little bio about him. He founded and directed the Hahnemann Foundation of Dying Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which was the first residential facility in the United States to support conscious dying. So he's cool. That was Dale Borgum. We've got another clip of him. He's going to talk about consciousness when we go on to the literal part of dying. But right now we're wrapping up the psychological side. So what do you think about what he said? He was talking about, you know, just being with unpleasant symptoms, being with those unpleasant feelings, and, you know, leaning into it, I guess.
I've heard a lot of different people talking about that. Like,
yeah,
once you stop labeling it, and, you know, if you can just be with a sensation, it doesn't have to have a label, pain or pleasure or anything. I've heard it enough times to think it's an interesting concept.
Well, I think too, you know, I guess I've, let's see, what have I done that I've hurt myself really bad?
Pardon me?
I'm trying to think of what I've done where I've hurt myself pretty badly, and initially it hurts, you know, but then your endorphins take over.
Well, maybe initially it's just a sensation, and then we add a word or, you
know, identify it.
Yeah, so it's like when you're in the midst of pain, I don't think you think I'm in pain, you just are in the sensation. And then as soon as whatever the initial impact was,
yeah,
then you go, oh, I'm in pain.
Holy. So. Or I guess I've hurt myself before and it's been like, ouch, that hurt. And then I reached my hand up and touched my head and then saw that I was bleeding. And the pain was exponential after
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, once, oh my God,
I knew
I'm dying.
I was hurt, I was posed.
Yeah.
Or I had this, I'd taken my first son to the dentist and he was about 5 and he had to go and get a cavity filled, and they drilled on him without Novocaine because they said that they don't know,
he's too young,
they don't know to identify it as pain.
Oh, well, that's another one of the things that I thought once was, like, let's say you're hit by a car. If you come back from it, you're in pain, you're injured. If you never come back, then you never have to translate.
Had the reaction.
Yeah, it's like,
pain.
Oh, that was, yeah, because it's over. So maybe you don't, you know, in something that takes you out, you mm-hmm. don't even, it doesn't hurt because it's sensation gone.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of consolation prize.
Man, I mean, that's what, it is a consolation prize if you can
if you can get out of life without pain and suffering. But I mean, I think that's what all the religions say is you don't.
But then you go to heaven or you get virgins or...
Ooh, virgins.
Or you go to the promised land or they have consolation prizes.
Well, we're going to go to my big brother's bedroom right now.
Okay.
Here's a song for everybody. Enjoy. We got 5 minutes left.
Yay.
Okay. So, what literally happens when you die?
Now what?
Oh, you're going to play that guy about...
So, Buddha at the gas pump talks about consciousness.
Yeah.
And so, let's listen to what he has to say, and we'll respond. Here we go.
The dying process, or you know, my impending death could be very unpleasant. Or, you know, like if you dangled me from the Golden Gate Bridge by my heels, I would be very fearful. And, you know, as philosophically convinced as I am that no one ultimately dies, I'd be, you know, shitting a brick, so to speak, you know, under that circumstance. So, I don't know, riff on that thing where you know, intellectually we might be totally convinced about the eternality of the soul and all, but when we're actually confronted with it, especially in a very immediate sense, maybe our intellectuality doesn't hold up so well.
Well, I've been around a lot of people who have died, and I've been around a lot of people who have been unconscious for periods of time before they died. People have been demented at the end of their lives. People have been in a great deal of pain at the end of their lives. And my deep belief is that consciousness, the function of consciousness is to grow and change. And it doesn't care how it gets you there. It doesn't care how long it takes or how much it hurts. So if in fact you're somebody who has been in control all of your life, you've been an executive or a very organized person, and toward the end of your life, for maybe a few months or even a few years, you are experiencing dementia. It might be expensive for your family, it might be painful for your family to compare who you are now with who you used to be, but you are learning somewhere deep in there to let go of control. You are being forced to confront mind states that before you were successful in avoiding. Maybe somebody's a very busy person and now they're bedbound for a long time. They have to learn to receive. They have to learn to allow other people to love them and take care of them and to be quieter. So these might not be easy lessons, and I would certainly agree that being hung by one's heels from the side of the Golden Gate Bridge, unless one were a very great yogi, would be a very frightening thing. But right now, the Living Dying Project has at least two clients who have ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways people often die with Lou Gehrig's disease is as they become increasingly physically paralyzed, their lungs begin to fill up with fluid and they don't have the muscular ability to cough, so they almost drown, and then they're suctioned out, maybe put on a ventilator, and various things happen, and then they almost drown again, and they almost drown a bunch of times till they finally drown. And if, as you can imagine, I don't know if that's quite the same as being hung upside down over a long fall, but it would take a very great yogi to not be frightened by almost drowning again and again and again. But what is happening to this person? If he or she has skillful, loving, compassionate support, they're learning to deal with that fear, the fear that is there when they're actually going to die. All fear is fear of death. Mm. And fear of death is exactly equal to lack of enlightenment, because it's the place where you or I are identified with our separateness.
Yeah, there's an Upanishad which says certainly all fear is born of duality.
Yeah, exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
So the part of you that's hanging upside down and is concerned about shitting a brick there is your fear of death. And another way of defining spiritual practice is learning to heal our fear of death, learning, in fact, that we aren't separate. Yes, we have the body, yes, we have the personality, but we are pure living spirit. We are presence. So that fear, if one is working deeply enough with enough motivation, is food for growth. Now, it's not the kind of growth I would wish on you.